Welcome to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. I'm Yvonne Booz. This month, we feature the former West Hollywood, California Poet Laureate, Kim Dower. Kim served as the Poet Laureate from 2016 until 2018. She's published 6 poetry collections. In this episode, we discuss her latest book, What She Wants, Poems on Obsession, Desire, Despair, and Euphoria. We also talk about the importance of creating a strong foundation for the craft. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for joining me. So I did do a little bit of research on you, and I did get the book. So thank you so much for sending that book, What She Wants. I love it. I think I'm on page 102, and I just started this morning.
Wow.
There's so many poems that I can relate to in that book. So thank you for sharing your gift with the world.
Welcome.
So I know that you got started writing when you were young. You talked about your grandmother. I was looking at another interview on YouTube. You're talking about your grandmother used to say poetry, and it wasn't in English, but you could just remember the cadence and how she said it. And you also said that you really started writing when you went to college. But tell me, before college, what type of writing were you doing?
You know, I was doing what all kids do. You know, I have my little journals. I had a blackboard in my room with my dolls, and I would play school. And I do remember writing little things on the chalkboard. It was nothing exceptional. It's not like I won the award in fourth grade, you know, for the best poem. But I liked to express myself through writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved reading books, you know, with poems that rhymed, you know, like A.A. Milne, Their Changing Guard at Buckingham Palace, Christopher Robin Went Down with Alice. You know, I just remember, you know, it's very pleasurable to hear rhyme and to hear poetry. So I wrote poems for my school newspaper. I would write poems a lot. It wasn't what I learned later was writing a poem, you know, the craft of it. And it was playing, which was fun. You know, it was great.
Now, in college, you talked about your professor, and you said that it was his first class and your first poetry class. Do you remember what was the first thing you wrote? And how was that different from what you had previously been doing?
Wow. wow. No one's asked me that question. And ironically or not, something just came into my head that I totally forgot. They say that you don't remember your good reviews. You just remember the bad ones. And I don't remember sort of the good poems and moments, but I remember this. Because Thomas Lux, the professor, you know, he was a perfectionist. He was very young. We didn't have this sort of politically correct attitude in the classroom that we do today. You know, a teacher could throw a book across the room, you know, and this is the 70s. It was like the Wild West. And, you know, people just got away with things. And it wasn't so shocking. It was just life. You know, we weren't traumatized by it. But he was, you know, super critical about certain things, which I think years later he wouldn't be in a classroom because none of us are allowed to be, and we shouldn't be. But I remember I wrote a poem that I had marshmallow clouds. I wrote marshmallow clouds in this poem, and he just went on about the marshmallow clouds, like, you know. It's bordering on a cliche. Cliches are the enemies. You know, do better. Marshmallow cloud doesn't say anything. I mean, it was like on and on. And I realized, well, I'll tell you something. I felt good at the moment because I knew this is a real thing. Poetry is real. It has its rules. You do want to do your best. Every word choice is important. So as much as I might have left the class and never written again, you know, I mean... That was a possibility. I felt like, hey, I can do better than marshmallow clouds. I understand why that's not going to be working. And well, actually, I do remember one of the poems that that I wrote called My Three Babies. And he was teaching a lot of surrealism at the time. And so this was a very surrealistic poem about my three babies. I remember my first substituted coughing for breathing. She had no face, no nose. And I wrote about my three babies, and I was very excited by the poem because it was so different and I don't know where it came from. And that was my first feeling of poems sometimes come to you and you don't know from where. So yeah, those were very early 17-year-old poems written in that class.
Oh wow. Now, how did that shape the rest of your poetry compared to what you had been writing before? Like, could you tell a difference in your work? Like for me, I started writing when I was 11, and when I look at those old poems, and I can even remember feeling like I can't say that or I might offend this person. But as I grew, I didn't care anymore. I didn't care if I used a word that people were not familiar with because I'm like, they could look it up. So, what was that experience for you looking back to what you used to do to how your craft evolved?
Well, I think just what you're saying, I can really relate to things that y mattered when we're very young and inexperienced and afraid and want to please, and all the things, especially young women, are always wanting to do. You know, what will they think of this? What will they think? That fades, sort of drops to the wayside when the poem takes over and the craft of poetry takes over. And your worries and fears about who you're going to please or not please fall away. And I think that's a really good point you make because when the craft takes over, really nothing else matters. You know, I mean, I don't mean to sound ridiculous, but like a physician, you know, they're doing a job, you know, in an operating room. They're not worrying about, you know, blood gets everywhere. It's like, they've got to get rid of it, sew it up, do it right. And you're just in the zone of that poem. And that is the greatest place on earth to be. And once those other things start coming in your head, like, oh, I might offend, or what would my mother think, or what
Or my grandmother.
my grandmother, it's like, now look, come on, we've all had that, and we still do. And that is, you know, I think it was Annie Lamott, I think, you know, her great book Bird by Bird, but I think that she actually said, don't worry about if you offend someone in your poems, it's because they did something that deserved to be offended by. I'm not quoting her exactly, but that's the idea. And I think about that often. You know, something sneaks into a poem and I think, well, you know, they asked for it.
It's their karma. Now, you were the Poet Laureate of West Hollywood from 2016 to 2018. Tell me about that experience.
It was a great experience. It was so much better. It was nothing like I thought it would be. And the poet laureate before me, a really wonderful poet named Stephen Rains, he was the first poet laureate of West Hollywood. And his tenure was ending, and they put up the notices to apply. And the word apply and a computer and filling out a form, those things do not compute with me. I can't. And he came to my office and he said, I'm going to help you apply for this. And I'm like, I can't log on. I don't know. And he really helped me do it. And it was a great experience because I had all these responsibilities that I never would have been given. I taught in some like third grade classes as poet laureate. I would go in. It's an experience I loved. I never would have had that. I was teaching poetry workshops at the West Hollywood Library to adults, many of whom had never written poetry, and it changed their lives and they became really addicted and obsessed with it. And I still teach them now, and I love that class. We created a city poem where, you know, the arts people in West Hollywood are so fabulous because they love all these kinds of programs. So I had an idea of doing a collaborative poem, And they made me pads with prompts, and I would go around to the yogurt place, to the bar, to the library, to the park, and ask people to do the prompt. And then I made them all into one poem. And it was great. It was called I Sing the Body West Hollywood after Walt Whitman's I Sing the Body Electric. And, they put it on their website, they recorded it. So it was a lot of opportunity to talk to people about poetry. And as a poet yourself, I'm sure you've encountered when you say, I'm a poet, or do you like poetry? And the person says, no, I don't like poetry. I don't understand it. I never read it. And you're like, saying you don't like poetry is like saying you don't like food. There's something for everyone, right? So I ran into that a lot with people, and I'd say, well, do you have 5 minutes? I felt like a door-to-door salesman, do you have 5 minutes for me to bring you over to the other side of poetry? But I think I got through to some people.
It sounds like my, growing up, I was always talking to my brothers about, I wrote a poem and they could care less. And then when I self-published my books, I remember talking about something and my brother, he was like, oh, you should write a poem about that. And I was like, I did, it's in the book. And he's like, oh, well, at least I bought it.
Oh, yeah.
So that is
In
so
there.
funny. Now you talk about workshops. How does that help you with your craft, like teaching others? How does that inspire you to write more?
It's incredibly inspirational, because people in these workshops are so alive and they're so in it, and they give me ideas I never would have thought about. They see things in other people's work that I never would have seen. It's not until you are with adults, you teach other adults, and I don't really teach as much as I open doors for them. Because I'm learning as much as they're learning, and I bring in poems. So I bring in a diverse group of poems by different kinds of poets that look differently on the page, that have different point of views, and we read the poem and we talk about it. And I learn by their pointing things out to me. A poem I think I've known really well, like the Frank O'Hara poem, The Day Lady Died, about Billie Holiday, which is, of course, one of the most famous poems where he sees the headline on the New York Post. I know that poem well, and I handed it out in class, and the things that they see in the poem, I've never seen. And then we have a discussion. And so it inspires me because it proves to me every Saturday morning that poetry is alive, and it's you can see something different in the same poem over and over when it's a good poem.
Now, I also was listening to a podcast that you were doing, and in that podcast, you shared something about being away from writing for a lot of years. I think you said 15 to 20 years. What was going on in life that you just didn't have, well, I can't say have the desire, but you just didn't write?
Well, I came from, Emerson College, where I was writing, and then I taught there for 2 years, a very young instructor. They gave me this job. And I wanted to leave Boston because it was cold in the winter and got dark at 4 o'clock, and it was in the late 70s, and women poets were just really not revered at all or taken seriously. I mean, it was the dark ages, in a lot of ways. And the two great poets of that area had just, committed suicide, Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath. I mean, I really, it was depressing. I wanted to get away from that world that was, well, frankly, very male and very narrow in its focus. So, what do? You move to Los Angeles, California, land of opportunity, until the fires come, but that's another story. Anyway, so I did. I moved here and I was writing. But what happens is, I didn't have a community here. I didn't have a community of writers. I didn't know anyone here who was a poet and who was writing. And I got into the world of working and, having a career. And then I got married and I started a business and I had a child. And I would write little things and put them in my pocket, or I had like a notebook here or there, but I stopped actively. I mean, look, any of us who has a child knows that those early years, game over, unless you're not working. But I was working and had a child and had a business. So poetry was sort of edged out.
Yeah. Tell me about the job that you had. I read that you were a publicist. Was that your business that you started, or was that the job that you
That's
had?
my business. I started it. I'm celebrating, hard to even say this, but 40 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell me about that life.
Well, it's a good life. It's hard. It's changes. It's been changing for years, but I have a company called Kim from LA. And that name has a name for a reason. But I do publicity for authors, not poets, because there's no money in poetry and I'm not taking money from someone to promote. I'm doing my own publicity. Or, I had this wonderful person contact you. She's a goddess, Kristen. And she works with Kim from LA, and she said, I'm gonna make calls for you for your poetry book. And I'm like, okay. So I do a lot of bestsellers. I do a lot of first time unknown authors. I do publicity for books. And it's been a long career. Over the course of the career, I've done all the West Coast publicity for different publishers in the heyday when publishing, when you would read about the big parties and the shrimp cocktails and the big author tours, 15 city author tours. We'd send people out and have author escorts and all this. Well, times have changed, but I still do publicity and it's still fun. It's a challenge. It's harder. But it's my day job and it pays for my ability to go out and do my own book tour. Pays for, well, everything.
What made you want to start your own company?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I was working for a publisher, and as anyone with a job knows, there's constraints when you work for someone. Plus, you have to do all the books, the publicity for the books they publish. You don't have a choice. And I did a book a long time ago called Women Who Love Too Much. And I don't know if your readers would remember. I'm sure they're all much, much too young to know that book. But it was a book about women who, it was the first author who talked about love as an addiction, and that we choose, many of us, the wrong man, and we think because we love them, they will change. And every woman in the office, we were all young, we jumped on this book. And we went crazy. And I saw what I could accomplish if I loved a book and had sort of free rein. I did a lot for this book. It was the hugest book for 10 years, I think, in the 80s. It was the number one book. She was on Oprah's show, and that changed everyone's life. And I could see the power of being someone's advocate because no one ever heard of her. She was an unknown psychologist from from California. And I thought, you know what, if I could do this for her book, I should do this on my own. I guess I was ambitious.
That's wonderful. So I'm going to take a moment and give you a chance to say some poetry, whatever you want to share, and then we'll talk about your poetry.
Okay, well, that sounds fair enough.
Always say I love how I never tell people in advance, I'm going to have you do poetry because poets are always ready.
I am ready for you. Well, my new book, this is my sixth collection, actually. It's called What She
And
Wants.
thank you for sending me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's poems on obsession, desire, despair, and euphoria. And as you know, you're reading it, I order the book around a fairly new psychological term called limerence, which is limerence is the state of being obsessively infatuated with someone, and it's usually accompanied or often with delusional. It's not a good place to be, although you can have some fun in the state of limerence. No problem there. And there's four stages of limerence. The first is infatuation, and we all know what that stage feels like, and it feels pretty good. So the first poem in the book sort of sets the tone, even though it's about a dog. And often the titles of my poems are the first line. So
And I
the first,
saw that, so we'll talk more about that.
okay. So this is called She'll Do Anything for Food. She'll do anything for food, the dog walker tells me. She speaks quietly, not wanting to insult her heavy-boned, one blue, one brown-eyed beast tugging at her leash. We did a doggy ancestor test, she confides, discovered she's part wolf, part miniature poodle. Must be the poodle part makes her so ravenous. Small creatures are ruthless feeders. Think of enraptured rats gnawing their way through orange trees, babies nursing, sucking so fiercely they can burst a nipple. Think of your heart, size of a throbbing fist, the part of you that will do anything for love.
It's funny, when I was reading that, I was feeling the end, that last sentence, even before I got there. It was like my mind started thinking about comparing that dog doing anything for food to a woman wanting love that bad. So you did a
Oh,
wonderful job with that.
thank you. Thank you. I say in my classes, and I remind myself, there's poetry everywhere. You don't wait for the muse. You don't wait for, you look, you keep your eyes open. This was during a walk at lunch, or, we're supposed to walk how many steps every day. So I try to get up and walk. Sure enough, I went outside my office, and there's a woman with a dog tugging at her leash, and the dog starts to jump on me, which is, of course, frightening. And the woman says she'll do anything for food. And I thought, I hope not. And I came upstairs and wrote the poem.
That's wonderful. That reminds me of I was interviewing a 90-something-year-old poet, and she used to tell me about her day job. And I think during the interview, she said something about she would be writing poetry at work, but they didn't know. So
Yes.
that just reminded me of that. I wanted to ask you about. Why do you use the first line as your title? I noticed that as I was going through the poetry. And do you do that all the time?
No, not all the time. But sometimes it really lends itself to that takes out a loan. Interesting, it's sort of like it does use the material from the poem. A title is very important, as you know. A title invites the person in, and often, for me, when I'm reading a poem, if the title and the first two lines don't grab me, I move on. There's a lot of poems out there, and maybe I don't give them as much of a chance as I should, but I like sometimes to use the first line, I mean the title, as the first line, because it just brings you right into it. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. And in fact, a title can add what the poem needs or put you in the place getting you ready for the poem. I had a class with a wonderful poet named Tim Siebels once, and he, every poet you take a class with, they give you some sort of trick or some, you don't even know half the time if what they're saying is true. Like they could, did they just make it up on the spot in the class? But he said often, if you can't think of a title, look at the second to the last line of the poem, and there's your title, which is really interesting. So I started doing that. I started looking at the second to the last line, and he was right. There's something because you're gaining momentum, you're almost finished, you're almost, and there's sort of the title. So I have done that a few times.
Oh wow, I'm gonna have to apply that to my journalism because that sometimes I struggle with just writing the title when it goes to me writing the print version. I'm just sitting there like,
Yeah, titles are really important and sometimes they're very hard to do. But I love titles and I love, oftentimes, it's the title that just swims right into the poem, you know, and I guess I have done that a lot. And just speaking of writing a poem at work, I've had various assistants and, you know, I'm doing my Kim from LA and it's serious and all this. But if a poem hits me, I'm like, okay. So I had an assistant once, and she, we were hungry, and so she went to Subway to get us a couple of subs for lunch. And I used to always get the vegetarian one, and she was very cute and worried because she comes in back to the office, and she comes in the room, and she looks very concerned. I go, what's the problem? And she says, Kim, they discontinued carrots. And it was at the sub, they discontinued carrots. They weren't selling them anymore. And I said, Carolyn, thank you so much. Please go in there. Don't talk to me for 20 minutes. I have to write a poem because the title, they discontinued carrots, I just thought that was a poem right there. So, you know, those are the best moments of the day for me, something like that.
I can definitely relate when I'm a part of this group. I co-founded it called A-Town Poetics in Aurora, Illinois. And just through the conversation, I constantly say that's a poem. Because of course, poets, I think they talk in poetry and they don't realize it. Like you said, swimming into the title, swimming into the poem. You know, we don't realize that we're using poetry every day. And then I wanted to ask about, there's so much I want to talk about. And I'm looking at the time, but I wanted to ask about the length of your poems. Some of them are short, some of them are longer. As a poet, sometimes I'm like, okay, is this it? Is this over? When do you know when the poem is done? Like, at what point do you say, you know, that's enough? Because I saw there was even one poem that was like just three lines.
Yeah, well, that is the question everyone has, you know, in every class. And of course, you know, we have it. When do we know? Well, you know, when do you know poem is done? When the poem is done, it tells us. It's like it gets up and walks off the desk. You know, bye, see you later. And it is absolutely, unquestionably done. Like the poem that I just read, that poem is done. She'll do anything for food. That last line, this the part of you that will do anything for love. That is a moment where you say thank you, thank you. You know it's done. Now, there are all those other poems that like, oh, you can't, it's just not done. It's you haven't satisfied the need of that poem. That poem is still saying, we're not finished here, you know. And you feel it. That's all it is. It's a feeling, you know. Now, there are cases where you take a poem like that to a workshop and you think it's done, and then people in the workshop are like, you know, does the poem want to say more? You know, people are so kind, they don't just say the poem's not good the way it is, but do you think there's more the poem wants to say? Is that the best choice for an ending? You know, then you know, okay, it's over. This poem is not done. And there are many cases in my poems when I was still sharing with other poets, or when I asked an opinion where they said, drop the last line, you finish the poem the line before. You say one thing too much, and and they're right. Now, you need to sit with everything. So when I've been told, get rid of that last line, and I'm thinking, what do you know?
Who are you? This is I created this. Who are
Who
you?
asked you? And then I think, well, you asked them. But anyway, so I always, if I admire, respect, if I've asked someone, I will do what they suggest. And you put it aside. And a week later, you look at it. You look at it without that last line. And 9 out of 10 times, they were right. Especially with me, because I say things twice. I'm going to do it right now. I'll say things twice. And I already finished. So it's very tricky, your question. How do we know? We don't always know. But when the poem is really ended, it tells us there's no question.
Now, I also remember when you talked about taking that 15 to 20 year break that you talked to someone and they said you lost the craft. Can you remind me who was it you talked about? And did you get it when he said you lost the craft? Because I think that would have escaped me.
No, I totally got it. So it was Thomas Lux, who is my first teacher at Emerson College when I was 17, and he was a mere 25 or 26. And and in the years that followed, he became just an incredible poet, and he is an incredible poet for anyone in your audience listening. Lux, Thomas Lux. There's not a poem he's written that you won't fall in love with that doesn't show what exactly he's talking about in terms of craft. And he wrote a poem called An Horatian Notion about building a poem, that a poem is built like a building and you lug the tools and you, and he's got a line, I'll read it, but about why I write and maybe you write and most of us, you make the thing because you love the thing. And you love the thing because someone else loved it enough to make you love it. That's the kind of teacher he was. So he was a craftsman. I mean, the muse, all of the wonderful things that go into a poem, sense of humor, flowing music, all that's great. But without the craft, so the craft, the line breaks, the pauses, the stanza breaks, too many words, not the exactly right word. All of these things, a poet's toolbox that we all have, which is, of course, language, the vocabulary, the music, the iambic pentameter or not. All of these things are in our toolbox as a poet, and the things in our toolbox are what make the craft. So when I, after a long period, sent him about 10 poems to see if I still even was in the game at all here. He said to me very honestly, well, first he said, the warranty has expired, which he was kidding, but that was hilarious. That was him. Kimmy, he would call me, Kimmy, the warranty has expired. And I'm like, okay, thank you. But he said, no, really, he said, you still have the humor, you still have the imagination, you still have the ideas, you still have all these things, but you've lost the craft. You need to get into a workshop where you will be reminded of that. And I took it to heart and I signed up for a workshop in Los Angeles where I went every Saturday morning for 12 years, 10 to 12. I waited all week for this class. 10 people, you hand out your poems, you read them aloud, and then there you go, off and running. Does the third word in the second line work? Like really zeroing in. And I relearned what's important, what makes a poem a poem. I'm sure you get this question all the time. What's the difference between prose and poetry? It's an annoying question. But I guess it's a valid one, and people ask it all the time. But I always say prose is like hiking, and poetry is like dancing. But we as poets have a responsibility that prose writers don't have. We have to be as concise as possible. We have to choose our words exactly right. We don't have the luxury of going on with long sentences and paragraphs and chapters. We have to say the most in the least amount of words. And that's where the craft comes in, right?
Yeah, it reminds me, and I always repeat this. I was interviewing Zilka Joseph, a poet, and she teaches and does a lot of stuff. And she told me, she was talking about everything you write is in a poem. And I said, explain that, because who are you to say that what someone wrote was in a poem? And that's when she said, you don't just write it. You have to really go back and rewrite it and fix it and make sure that it's perfect. You just don't write it and say, here's a poem. It
Right.
has, you have to work at it. You have to
Right.
change, rearrange. It's something that you really, like you said, is something that you build. And I get it. As you talk about it, it reminds me of that sentence that everything you write is in a poem. How important do you think workshops are to poets? Even like you have been writing for years and then you stopped and started back. Like, tell me, how did that really season your work?
I think it's very important for numerous reasons, until you're done with it. You know, it's in a way, I guess, like therapy. Therapy can be so helpful. Talk therapy, it literally can change your life, can focus you on what matters, can help you understand yourself, can really do work. It's hard work, good therapy. And then one day, therapy ends. You say, you know what? I'm done with this. I have the tools. I have what I need. I don't need to talk about this stuff anymore. Well, the same is true in a poetry workshop, I think, because here you have people really helping you focus about what your work is. They're kind of a springboard. So when you read a poem and then the teacher says, you know, what meanings do you take from this poem? You hear what 10 people think the poem means. Now, doesn't really matter what meanings people take from a poem as long as they take something. But if you're hearing people say what they think it means that has nothing to do with what you intended, you need to go back to the drawing board. If there's words in it, you know, one of the things in a workshop is what surprises do you see in the poem? Well, if no one has any answers for that, you have failed in that poem. Because the poem has got to be full of surprises. You know, that's what you want. So you listen, and it's not that people are critical, it's just that they are, you are seeing and hearing what their feelings are. And these workshops that I've attended, they're not about this is good, this is bad. They're about what the poem is, at looking at it as a house. Like, well, that second floor needs a little more tightening up because it's kind of loose up there and the person can fly out the window. You know, they're looking at it as, you know, William Carlos Williams says a poem is like a finely crafted machine. So the answer to your question, a short answer is it helps you hone your craft. Because A, you have to bring a poem in every week. You have to keep writing. You listen to other people talk about other people's poems. You have to engage about other people's poems. Therefore, you learn about your own situation. And it's hard work. And I would take a poem back that I thought was almost finished with notes on the page from every single person. And I'd put all those poems out on the dining room table and I'd look and I'd think, eh, don't care about that. Oh, very interesting what they're saying here. I'm going to try to incorporate that. And then it would be weeks on just one, working on one poem, editing it.
Oh wow. Now, I love this book because of course most people probably can relate to it, but I love how the honesty. You talk about other girlfriends, which a lot of people wouldn't even want to talk about. What are you talking about? He has another girlfriend. And then the one I relate to is not that. And it, the way you talk about trying to pull something out someone, where does that come from? Is that your personal things that you've gone through personally, or is it empathy where you're watching others? Because I do that a lot. I'll watch someone else and then I'll write the poem and I'm like, ha, you don't know it's not about me, or you don't know it's about you, because I didn't really reveal that, but there's something you said or something you did that gave me this poem.
Everything you just said, you just said it. It's a combination of all those things. People think poems are autobiographical. It's a very nasty mistake. It's not fair. You can write a murder mystery. You can be a crime novelist, have the most wretched crimes. No one's going to come up to you after signing and say, "Wow, did you really, sledgehammer those five people in the van?" It's not. But poets, because we exude this personal, this empathy and all this, people like, wow, is that you? So because you're a poet. No, it's not you. It is a combination. It's a combination of what you know because you're writing it. It's coming from you. But it's also all the things out there that we've seen, that we've heard, our girlfriends' books we've read, things we've seen, movies. It all kind of comes together, and we don't know how it comes to us and comes out on the page. Sometimes I close my eyes. I used to play the piano, and my piano teacher, Barbara, she had the most beautiful posture. She'd sit very erect and her back straight, and she would play the piano with her fingers. So sometimes I'll close my eyes and sit at the computer and just type. And things come out, and I don't really know where they're coming from. But poems can be generated by a prompt, like, I'll do anything for food, or they can be generated by a strong emotional feeling. And maybe I wrote that poem a long time ago. I was probably feeling exasperated, frustrated, sad, upset, all of these things. And that's maybe what came out in writing that poem. But yeah, it's a complex situation how it falls out on the page. What brings it there?
Now, do you have another poem you would like to share?
I'll think of a short one. I mean, the next one in the book is Unruly Aura. It's sort of a more of a funny poem, but it's again, it's that stage of limerence where, oh, everything's a fantasy. Unruly Aura. The cashier at the health food store tells me I have a beautiful aura. Wait, I tell her. If you want to see a really beautiful aura, wait until I've taken my RenewLife Ultimate Flora Probiotic. After that, my aura will knock your socks off. She smiles at me and rings me up. My money has a beautiful aura, too. My dollar bills float from my pink wallet. The man behind me swells from the heat I generate. Each step I take brings me closer to God, the final fabulous aura. Take my hand, I tell her. Squeeze my aura. It's hungry and looking for someone to devour.
I love that. It made me think of the poem that you did about the boob job when you said, "Take my hand," when she's like, "Do you want to touch?" And that was a real that was something that you experienced. What I thought that was awesome that you went along with that, because not too many people would be like, "Okay, I'll touch him." It's like, really?
Yeah, that's a real story, that poem. That really happened.
I love how your poetry is like, you talk about so many different things, and you can take one little one little topic and just expand it and make it so large and beautiful. And I was reading where you were talking about the gelato cafe. I'm like, how could she make this sensual? How'd that happen? How does she? And I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, that's what she's talking about. And I love that. And I think a lot of people say they don't like poetry because they just don't get it. They don't get it. They don't understand. I could be talking about one thing and they don't see it. And then when I explain it to them, they're like, oh. And I'm thinking, oh, this is clever because I'm talking naughty and they don't even know it.
It's true. Yeah, well, but what you said, you take 1 minute, 1 moment of something and you expand it. And I think that's what poetry is. I mean, I also say in class all the time that we're journalists. Our job is to report what we see, but in a way that's never been reported before.
That is interesting. I remember at the station when I started Poetically Yours, it was like a question of, but is this journalism? And my news director was like, this is definitely journalism because even with my poets, the certain times or things that's going on, I'll send a call out to them to say, hey guys, like after the election, I know everyone's in a different mood. Write about it. Let's let our listeners hear about this because they
Yeah.
could probably relate to that. So that is a true statement. It's people don't look at it that way, but they kind of coincide
Yeah.
like
Yeah.
that. And then I read the poem about where I listened, I didn't read it, about the you talked about your mother, I wore this dress for you.
Yeah.
That was so touching because it makes me think, oh, my mother's still here. How do I want to communicate and make sure she feels warm now that she's here? What is it that I haven't done for her that I should be doing just to let her know? And I'm like, oh, this has inspired me to write more poems about my mother and to her because I haven't, like, that's the one person I don't write about too much. And I had
Yeah.
all these poems about my father because of the way he made me feel growing up, but I never wrote too much about that my mother, but that poem made me think, oh, I need to write to my mother more often. And then the one that the letter to your son.
Oh,
And you start talking
yeah.
about dementia, my granny had that, and
Yeah.
just to hear you talk about possibly going through that and letting your son know if this happens, it's okay. That's a big thing because a lot of people don't want to talk about stuff they don't want to encounter. It's like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to speak that into existence. So it's so brave of you just to put it out there on the paper.
Well, thank you. Thank you. For your listeners and the poets, I will say that I didn't think I would publish that poem. And here's a case where people's opinions, whom you trust, are important. But I started doing something back then where I would dictate a poem. Instead of writing it down, and I was taking a walk and I was feeling kind of low, and I was thinking about my mother and, working with her when she had dementia, and my grandparents. And I said, letter to my son, and I started dictating this, and it's a prose poem. So for listeners, you use your phone, these handy little obsessive machines we all have. You dictate into the voice memo, and then you email it to yourself. When I got back to my office, there in my email was what I had dictated, letter to my son. And I put it in a Word doc and I printed it out. And I spent a long time on that, but the bones of it were there. And it came from my heart, from a place that I wasn't ready for this poem to come out. I didn't even know it was gonna come out. And I asked a good friend, do you think this should go in this book? And he said, oh, absolutely. So, there are things like that you're not sure about. They're very close to you. And it is the poem from that book, the two that you named, I Wore This Dress Today for You, Mom, and Letter to My Son, that people always want to hear, that mean a lot to them. So, yeah, thank you for mentioning that.
No problem. And I always think, like, as a poet, I have to always remember this is not about me. It's not for me. It's for somebody else. That's the magic of poetry because it's a gift, but it's a gift that we're giving other people.
Exactly.
Now,
Exactly.
I know you have a lot going on with the new book out, and I also heard that you wanted to really promote it for Valentine's Day with it being love. And love isn't always that fun, but you know, we take those experiences. Tell me what's next for you.
Well, probably lunch, with extra mayo and I like iceberg lettuce. I'm one of the few people who actually sees the
Oh,
benefit in
my
it.
granny used to eat it like the whole head of lettuce. She'd sit there and eat the lettuce.
Well, she had dementia, so no, I'm kidding. But anyway, yeah, no, I probably would do that too if I was in a room by myself. But anyway, I'm out there actually doing readings all over, promoting this book, which is it's fun. It's really fun. It's really fun talking to you. And I was in the Bay Area the other day. I went to Sonoma, where I'd never been. It's such a pretty little town. Oh my God, California, and I did a reading at a store called Book Passage. And then I am in 2 days taking a train, the Pacific Surfliner, to San Diego, which is so much fun. I do the book tour as also a chance to do little trips to see old friends. And I'll read at a great store in La Jolla called Warwick's. And then I'm going to read here. I'm going to Portland to read with my great friend Karen Carbo. And I'll go to New York. And hopefully I'll make my way to Chicago in June.
Oh wow, when it's nice. Well, it might be hot, but won't
Yeah,
be
no, it's
cold.
nice. Nice in June. There's a great store called The Bookseller in Chicago, and I have family there. My husband's family is in Chicago, and I love Chicago. It's just, it's an incredibly beautiful city. So yeah, so I'm doing that. Now, it's very hard to write while all this is going on, and I don't love that a lot because I really need to. We've had a lot of tragedy here, and I'd love some quiet time to kind of write or think about it, but I'm not going to have that. I'm not going to have that for a while, and yeah, so that's okay. But and if I have a new poem that I write, I keep on my desktop. I have poems in play, poems in progress, poems not published. Don't ask me the difference between those three
The
words.
three P's.
Yeah, really. I have no idea. And why one goes into poems in play and poem and poem in the works, I don't really know. It's very confusing. I just wanted more folders on my desktop. But so one day, maybe in 6 months, I'll take a little peek in there. And I'll say, oh, look at you. You look promising. Come on out. And I may at some point go to a workshop again. I'll start teaching at the West Hollywood Library in May. And I'm teaching a class at this great place called Beyond Baroque, an art center in Venice, California, in June. So, I mean, I've got things, in the works, and that's my story.
Now, is there anything I didn't ask you that you would like to share with our listeners?
Oh, you have just done the greatest interview ever. I
Well,
mean,
thank you.
oh, thorough, and having read my other poems and talked about, I mean, you're just amazing. I couldn't think of anything you didn't ask me except for, why am I wearing a big orange coat while we're doing this interview?
You're in California now, right?
Yeah, and it's freezing. I have no heat in my office here. And yeah, that's, I don't know. It's crazy, but I work every day fully dressed with layers of clothes.
Like I am in Chicago.
Wow. I mean, what a great city to live in.
Yeah, but I deal with the winter blues too when you talk about it being
Yeah.
dark. Thank you so much for joining me for the Poetically Yours podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. What a joy.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. Special thanks to the Nick Monte Trio Band for providing the music for this podcast. Listen to Poetically Yours every Friday during Here and Now and All Things Considered. For Poetically Yours, I'm Yvonne Booz.